Living Room Logic.
So welcome back to another episode of Living Room Logic, and we've been covering a lot of really interesting stuff so far this season, a lot of things like psychology and a lot of ways to improve our life. But one thing that we do every single day that we don't consider probably enough is what we put into our body. And the best way to think about it and be educated on it to know how to best fulfill our diet. And I think a big part of that is trying to understand how the way food gets processed before it actually gets to us so we can make more informed choices. In order to discuss this and to learn about it today, I'm very, very happy to talk to Professor Alan Kelly. He's a professor in the School of Food and Nutritional Science in the University College Cork, but I actually know him more so from Twitter puns, which is where I more often see him, and a few books that I've scanned looking at science communication, which, as everyone knows, is very important to me and I find very, very interesting. So I'm really looking forward to speaking to you. But I think we'll dive straight in, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about the phrase processed food. And I'd like to address that straight away, because when I think of processed food, I think of chicken nuggets, which are chicken nuggets, but the whatever aspect that was chicken has been completely changed, and somehow we're being told that it just resembles meat, but we're not too sure. And when I hear processed food, I also think that's not healthy. I think that less processed food is better, and that processed food is actually worse. But is this right? Like, I'm not 100% sure. Is this idea of processed food wrong? And if you were going to talk about processed food, how would you do it?
Great. And first of all, thanks for the invitation to be on the podcast. I'm delighted to have an opportunity to talk about these issues and really important issues. And let me say from the upfront, I'm coming at this, I'm a food scientist. I guess I'm not a nutritionist. So I'm going to come at it from a very different perspective, maybe on what the word processing and process means, because I think to me, it has a very different connotation. And I think, and we could say, you know, some of this is about semantics, but I think it's important to ask, what do we do to food before it gets to consumers, and why do we do it? And I think that's kind of the underpinning question. So what I'd like to do is kind of go right back and figure out, what do we do to the raw materials that we turn into food, and why do we do them? And then where has that brought us to today, that this, you know, that we have concern around what processing means or what the term process means. So like, I'd start off by saying that every food material more or less is some kind of has a biological origin, right? They're all complex biological systems. They're plant materials, they're animal materials, they're cereals. And by definition, that makes them unstable in some way or another. And in a way, like, we've selected over millennia, we selected these are things we're going to eat. You know, I study milk, and I think it's interesting to remind ourselves every now and again that milk is the only thing that was designed by nature to be consumed. Everything else is something that we've made a decision we're going to consume, you know, and we've made those decisions over a very long period of time, right? But like, everything we consume is because it's nutritious for us. And one of the kind of unavoidable facts is what makes it suitable for us, in many cases, makes it attractive to things which could cause us problems, particularly microorganisms, right? So you know, if we look at food under a microscope, if we look at most food raw materials, you know, they're literally thriving with life of one form or another, either coming from where we got it from or coming from contamination. And over thousands of years, we figured out that for food to be good for us to eat, to be safe, to be stable, to be able to transport it, we've had to transform it in one way or another. And that's what processing means to me, is transformation. It's transformation of the state of it, or the stability of it, or number one, I think something that doesn't come out often enough in conversations about this is safety. And the number one reason we do things is to make our food safe to eat, right? So I'm going to go back, like, I mean, we could go all the way back. There was an interesting guy from Harvard, I think, called Richard Wrangham, who wrote a book about 10 or more years ago called Catching Fire. And he had a hypothesis that one of the key steps in the evolution of modern humans was the ability to cook our food. Because basically, you know, we're the only species who cooks our food before we consume it. And as a result, if we consumed only raw food, whether it be raw vegetables or raw meat, we would spend a huge amount of our bodily energy budget digesting. Whereas by cooking it, we basically make it much easier to digest and absorb nutrients from. And as a result, his hypothesis was discovering somewhere, you know, millions or hundreds of thousands of years ago, human ancestors discovering how to cook their food suddenly was a revolutionary step and an evolutionary step in terms of letting them, you know, save a huge amount of energy that they could devote to evolving into modern humans. So, but if you go back then, you know, if you speed up that like I've gone right back to the dawn of civilization, which is a big canvas to work from, but you speed it up, so you know, I'm not going to go through it in real time, but if we speed up a couple of, you know, millennia, we get to milk, meat, basic things that we learned to convert. And there's another theory out there that says that, like, learning how to process food, and I'll define what I mean by that in a second, was key to the evolution of cities. Because if you weren't able to make food safe and make food last longer, because most food is inherently very perishable, then everybody would have to live on farms, and everyone would have to live where the food was produced, because they'd have to consume it almost immediately. Whereas the ability to make things last longer meant that they could be transported and people could have cities, because not everybody had to be a farmer. Because somebody, you could divide civilization into people who made the food and people who consumed food and did other things as well. And also, like, exploration and travel. Like, if you weren't able to bring food with you, you know, it limited your ability to move. So, like, going right through history, the ability to do things to food, to transform it in one way or another, was very, very important, right? And when I go back to what do I mean by that, I mean, people have been doing the things we associate with the, you know, modern food processing for a very, very long time, like cooking and then heating in one way or another, right? Refrigeration, keeping things cool, you know, building cellars or underground compartments where the temperatures are lowered to make things last. Drying, like, it's thought, you know, again, historians will argue that Incas in Peru basically knew how to freeze dry food, because they put it up on mountains where the pressure was quite low, and at night it'd be very cold and it would freeze. And in the morning, as it warmed up at low pressures, basically the water would evaporate. You know, people have dried food, you know, to make it last longer for a very long time. And you know, so some of our most basic food preservation techniques, drying, heating, cooling, have been around for a very long time. But the most kind of maybe one that's been with us for a very long time has been chemical preservation. And like there's one we maybe could confront head on, you know, and we could say, okay, there's one thing that consumers are always worried about. They talk about chemical preservations in food. But some of our oldest ways of preserving food have been chemical preservation techniques. And some of our most fundamental and common food ingredients, although we don't think of them that way, are chemical preservatives. I mean, one which has been around for a very long time and has had a massive value through history is salt, for exactly that reason. I mean, it amuses me sometimes you see products like, I know I've seen products like cheese alternatives, like for vegans. And on the front, it'll frequently say, contains no preservatives. And I always look at the back and I see about second or third in the list will be salt. It's not just a flavor. It's there as a preservative. Salt, acid. Whether we're pickling and adding acid, whether we are fermenting it, right? Again, fermentation has been something that's been done for a very, very long time. Like, you know, yogurt, cheese, you know, a lot of these products, wine, beer, are ancient. They go back to Greek and Roman civilization and further, because there are ways to preserve the raw materials. We'd no idea, but you're deferring, you know, deterring the growth of undesirable microbes by filling your food with desirable ones. And typically in the process, they were producing things that were that had a preservative effect, like alcohol, for example. When we produce, I mean, home fermentation to produce is very in trend nowadays, you know, but that's a very ancient technique as well. Smoking has been done for a very long time. Again, a very powerful chemical preservation technique. Sugar. Sugar, again, we associate with.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Maybe nutritional prospects and sweetness and sensory prospects, but sugar is a very powerful preservative. If you have bacterial cells and the presence of sugar, it tends to suck the water out of them, which helps to kill them. And then we have the most powerful chemical preservative of all, which is one that's been in food for a very long time, which is alcohol produced by fermentation. So, you know, many of our major food kind of categories emerged because of how to solve the problem of making food that won't kill you and that lasts long enough that you can bring it from place to place and that you can transport it. And like, I mean, if you look at, say, if I could take one example, you'd take milk, right? Milk, I mean, every dairy product is a different solution to the problem of how do you make milk stable. I mean, in Ireland, they've been making butter from milk. And I'm burying it in bogs for mysterious reasons for thousands of years. I mean, archaeologists frequently dig up 4,000 or 5,000 year old samples of bog butter, as we call it around Ireland. But like, I mean, it's taking milk and preserving. Like, one of the things we want from food is energy. And one of the most energy rich parts of food is the fat. Right. So, you know, thousands of years ago, people in Ireland and elsewhere figured out that if you want to preserve that, you know, during the winter, during times of plenty or times of the opposite of plenty, whatever that might be, you know, one way was to dehydrate it, salt it and concentrate. And that's why we make butter. You take cheese and it's dehydrated. It's fermented. It's acidified and it's salted. You know, and it's funny, you can take like so many food products emerge because we're taking these kind of, there's only a certain number of basic processing principles. And if we put them together in certain ways, then we get different dairy products, for example. You know, we dry it, we pasteurize it, you know, so, or we freeze it and we make ice cream. They're all different ways of approaching the task of how do we make milk, how do we make it transportable. So, you know, I think that like basically, processing has been around for a very long time. It's been with us through civilization. It's not something that the food industry has suddenly decided to spring on us nefariously. But one thing that I'm sure has caught your attention and your listeners' attention is, okay, I've mentioned a few things in there as being around for a very long time. I've measured salt and sugar and fat. And when you talk about the types of processed foods you think about, you often think about, you know, okay, they're negatives. They're things that we might associate. This is cheap food with too much sugar in it, or it's too salty, or it's too high in fat, right? And you can say now, like, that what's changed is our understanding that these ancient things we've relied on for a very long time, like our understanding of nutrition, our understanding of physiology, is so much better than it was. So, you know, the idea of, you know, oh, we'll make it stable by just throwing in a lot of acid or throwing in a load of salt. We now know, okay, there's limits to how much we can do that. So processing is becoming, is kind of, we're kind of modifying and refining things as we go along, you know, based on our understanding of, you know, these things, just because they've been done for a long time, we could do them better. You know, we make food in an extremely hygienic environment, so maybe we don't need all these preservation steps to apply to them. So I think food is evolving very rapidly in recent years in response to both consumer demands and better nutritional understanding of what's good for us and what might be too much of a good thing, if you want to put it in those terms.
That is a fantastic foundation to start this conversation.
Good.
It is thank you so much. That's brilliant. That's brilliant. The first thing I want to pull out of that you mentioned was something that never in my life crossed my mind, was that milk was the only thing designed by nature to be eaten.
Yeah.
That alone had me sit back for a second and go, oh my God, everything else is just trying to go about its business.
That's
amazing. And it got my head thinking, wow, we must have learned so much about how food is both made and how nutrition is balanced from something that nature has created just to be eaten. So that's fascinating. And then even going into that, we give so much credit to the agricultural revolution for civilizing humans. But like you said, that only goes so far. maybe that made it so you could have a homestead, that you had a farm that fed that. But this created, like you said, farms from elsewhere that would bring it in. But like you kept getting onto, this has been around for a long, long, long time. But what I would say is that this is all familiar ways of processing food.
Yeah.
Very familiar. Salt mm-hmm. doesn't bother me. Mm-hmm. Everything in my life has had salt in it, you know, to some degree. And same with alcohol. It's not a big deal. It's very normalized. Mm-hmm. But again, we may be optimizing it, but optimizing usually means new techniques and unfamiliar techniques and maybe introducing compounds without a proven history of being okay. Mm-hmm. So how do you think about that when you're introducing something brand new that maybe on the lab floor, it does a much more effect, like it could be a different kind of salt than our classic sodium, you know, it could be something like that, but it does a twice as good a job. It keeps food twice as well or anything like that. And trying to then say that to someone and be like, no, it is safe. It's just new. Because I think a lot of this maybe stigma or your instinct to pull back comes from how unfamiliar new processes is. Because like you said, everything you said there is totally good. Yeah, smoking stuff, freezing stuff, drying stuff. Yeah, totally cool. I've seen that in movies all my life, but I've never seen food crashing through a factory and being processed in bulk. That's not what I'd call a classic. That's not classically natural, you know?
But I think something that's really important to say, and I think you've raised a really important point, is that there is a suspicion, and you know, I'm not here to defend or attack the practices of the food industry or to get into to those kind of arguments, but like, I think it's really important that people have a confidence that food is one of the most regulated parts of our daily lives. And it's extremely regulated at an EU level and at an Irish level. If you go on to news sites, you know, on the RTE or the Journal, you'll regularly see such and such premises shut down for lack of standards, say, by the FSAI. We have really, because it's, you know, food is like the you know, if there's a problem with food, it can affect a lot of people very quickly. And that's why, but just to go back here, and it's a really interesting point. So what if somebody invented something in the morning? The one I often think of is that has every single property of milk fat, except it has zero calories. You know, does everything else. Yeah. Could they just launch that onto the market? And the simple answer is no. It'd take them years to do that, because we have, there are very strict criteria in the EU for what are called novel foods. So say if there's a process or an ingredient or a raw material, you know, they find some bacteria down at the bottom of the deep sea that they want to use to produce a new kind of beer or something, right? The key word is no history of safe use. Mm-hmm. That a company who wants to do that, and there are lots of examples, mainly I'm familiar with them through processing. And maybe we can take that example in a minute, but that you know, a company that wants to produce something will have to produce a dossier of evidence. And they'll have to examine that process or that ingredient or that microbe from every possible conceivable angle to convince the EU that this is safe to use. So I think it's really important that it's not a free-for-all. I think sometimes people think, you know, the food industry can just invent things, or labs can invent things and throw them onto the market without protection. That's absolutely not the case, at least not in the EU. Like, if I could pick one example, because, you know, something we might be interested to talk about is novel technologies and new technologies, right? And one of the big drivers, because I think if we look at the drivers of how food is evolving, if you like. And it's evolving pretty fast. Like, you've two different things. Like, you've what consumers want and you've what the food industry can give them, you know, and how they meet in the middle, right? And like, one of the biggest kind of terms in food processing for probably 20 years has been what's called minimal processing. And it's tackling head-on consumers' concerns about the idea that their food is overprocessed, and a kind of a watchword being, how can we make food that is as close to the natural, unprocessed version as possible, while still meeting our absolute requirement of anybody who's involved in producing or handling food, of making it safe. And I keep coming back to that one because I think it just gets lost in the debate sometimes. Like whether you're, you know, making dinner at home for friends, whether you're running a restaurant, or whether you're running a farmhouse cheese or a massive factory, the first responsibility is, if you're giving people food to eat, it has to be safe, right? So you can't get away from safety. It has to be, and everything else is a bonus once it's safe. But like, so a huge kind of is how can we make food that seems as fresh and as natural as possible? How can we change as little as possible while making it safe? And there's so much, like I'll take two examples. Like one is you go into the supermarket and you buy a bag of salad, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like for most people, there's a bag of salad and they bring it home and they open it. It's a plastic bag with air in it. And that's what you see. But to a food scientist, when you look at that, you know, like, first of all, it's not air, because air isn't going to, it will be everything that's in air. It'll be nitrogen and carbon dioxide and oxygen. But the ratios will be very carefully chosen to make sure it retains its color and its quality and everything. And the plastic will be very carefully chosen to make sure it protects the product and lets kind of the right gases and humidity and things in and out. So, you know, every aspect of food is very carefully chosen to make sure it's as safe as possible. And often we don't appreciate or don't kind of realize what we're seeing. But the other example I want to talk about, because it links to the regulation issue, is something you might see on the market. I saw it the other day in Dunn's stores, like kind of high-end juices. And you'll often see the term cold-pressed juice, right? Mm-hmm. And what that is produced, and sometimes just means how the juice is extracted, but more often what it means is instead of being heated to make it stable, right, which does make it stable and will kill bacteria and will kill yeast and molds and make it last longer, but might impact on the flavor and the nutritional quality, that it's been subjected to a process where it's put into a bottle, probably the bottle you're buying it in, and it's been put in a chamber where it's subjected to massive pressures instead of heat. And this is a fascinating process because it does the good stuff that heat does, which is killing the bacteria and making it safe and making it last longer, but it doesn't impact on the nutritional and sensory quality. And so we go around the country and you can see on shop shelves cold pressed juice, and it'll say produced using high pressures. And what's like, if you go back about 20 to mid 1990s, the first company, a big food company, wanted to use this, spent years trying to persuade the EU that this is safe to use, because they were the first people to want to use that process. And then that was for fruit. And then the next company who came along who wanted to use it in Spain, then it was launched for, the first application was in France for fruit, the second application was in Spain for meat. And it was a little bit easier because it had been shown it was safe for fruit, but they still had to show there was no negative impact on the meat. And today, 20, 25 years afterwards, it's more or less an accepted technology. But that's a technology that had to fight its case before consumers were able to get access to those products, because it had to be proven that this is safe. So, and you know, that's an important point, and it's a nice illustration of the fact that it's not just an unregulated, you know, companies can do whatever they want. It's a highly, highly regulated, and unless, you know, and it's the same if it's, you know, the salt that isn't salty or the fat that isn't fatty, whatever it might be, would have to go through exactly the same process.
Halfway through when you were talking, I just started picturing supermarkets more like pharmacies, that everything almost has gone through a similar process. Every aspect of it has gone through it. And I it makes me keep thinking, because I think a lot of people would almost assume that it doesn't. And they would assume that because it's natural and natural things don't need to be tested. And if you're throwing natural on a cover, it doesn't need to be tested. Mm-hmm. And for me, it gives me a sense of relief. Oh, great. Everything is, they make sure. But I don't know if everyone else would. Mm-hmm. I think some people would be like, why did it have to get tested? That's concerning, you know, even though it's like, well, it's like, why did fire get tested in case it hurts you? You know, you prefer to have these things tested and a big stamp of approval that just says, yes, this is safe. But I think a lot of people have this kind of image of if something had to go through safety testing, it must inherently have some assumption that it's dangerous.
But I think it should be a reassuring. I never thought about it that way. It should be a reassurance that nothing is, that we don't have access or we don't be subjected to anything that isn't shown to be safe. You know, but it'd be the same for anything. It'd be the same for any material, whether it be food or a new drug or a vaccine or anything.
Yeah.
You know, we'd like to have the confidence it's been through rigorous safety tests.
I completely agree. I have this image in my head of someone taking something as simple as salt in lab coats and masks and testing it like it's an explosive and then saying it's safe. But I from my own experience, I know that some people have this image in their head that anything that needs safety testing has inherently risk, which isn't necessarily the truth. And I think it's important to make that point. In that, I think for another stage of you were saying about keeping something as natural as possible. And I think that's another interesting point of how much processing, like how much saying, I think even the phrase from this conversation, something which is highly processed, doesn't mean a lot. It just means that something is being maintained or kept from going off for a longer time. But is there any sense that if something needs a higher degree of maybe processing or needing some kind of preservatives, that this pulls away from its maybe natural safety or anything like that?
Again, what are we trying to do? We're trying to make things safe and we're trying to make them last longer, right? And you have two kind of routes to doing it that we've kind of touched on already. And again, these aren't new. This is ancient stuff. That, like, one is what we do to it, whether we heat it or we dry it or we, you know, freeze it or we refrigerate it. And the other is to do with what we put into it. You know, how we formulate it. You know, that you know, do we... So, and I think a lot of the debate around processed food tends to be around the what we put into the food rather than what we do to it. And I think that's important. And can I just go back to the point about making things last longer, it can sound a little bit kind of cosmetic or, you know, just make food last longer, you know, shelf life. But I think it's really important. I always think, like, if we just think about why is shelf life good for us? I mean, shelf life is really important. It's really important to the food industry. And by industry, I use this in the broadest sense, because to me, like, you know, if you process something in a, you know, if you open a recipe book and you see a list of ingredients and a list of steps, like doing it in a larger scale, whether it be a farmhouse or a factory, it's pretty much the same thing.
Yes.
It's a question of scale. And in one case, you put it in a package and the other, you put it on a plate. You know, to me, the principles, the chemistry, the interactions, the reasons you're doing things are exactly the same on whatever scale. And like I have as a scientist, and, you know, I know I can get into lots of rows about this, but like I have a deep kind of concern about this idea that if it comes out of a kitchen, it's good. And if it comes out of a factory, it's bad.
Mm.
Because food isn't like that. Food is food.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
But anyway, I go back to the point about shelf life. And I just think, like...
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Shelf life is really important. The food industry knows how to make things last longer is the reason why, you know, on a modern lifestyle, you don't have to go to shop every day. You know, because you can buy things and know that they're going to last for long enough. And the other side of that is if we go into our supermarket, we go to wherever we're buying our food. Like the fact that we have access to food from all over the world is because the food industry has figured out how to make it last longer, get it to us in Cork or Limerick or Dublin, whoever we are.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, yes.
So preservation, the preservation side of it is gives us convenience. It gives us variety. It gives us interest, gives us exposure to things. You know, and as I say, like it, that can be achieved by two things, the physical processes like drying and heating and things, and the formulations. But again, I go back to the idea that while these are very ancient ideas, we understand better now how to do them. Mm-hmm. We know better how to get the best quality raw materials, how to minimize that processing, how to avoid sometimes unsubtle things we might have done in the past to make things that are healthier. And I think things are improving all the time. You know, I would like to think that food science and nutritional science working together to understand, you know, what's the minimum we need to do to make something safe and stable. And yet preserve its nutritional value and its goodness. I think that's these are really big drivers that people mightn't always appreciate are big trends. You know, it's not the food industry doesn't listen to and, you know, what consumers are looking for, because obviously if consumers don't want what people are producing, then that's not going to be good for those producers. You know,
for sure. And so, do you think that really the best thing going forward from a public perception of food processing is more so familiarization as opposed to just people being familiar that, oh, food processing is fine. That's what we do. It doesn't matter if it's from a factory or a kitchen. It's that familiarity, because like my mom, for example, would say, oh, it tastes like real food. you know what I mean? And the idea, but maybe that's just a social perception. So actually going forward.
Absolutely. There's a lot of social, you know, and social perception is really important. Like I had a student of mine, Megan Ross, who's just submitted her PhD on 3D printing of food. And we were very excited as food scientists. I published a paper a number of years ago on 3D printing of cheese that got quite a bit of attention because it was like, what are they doing trying to 3D print cheese, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, we did a study and we were very excited as food scientists that we could show that milk proteins, you know, were good materials for printing things. Mm-hmm. And I always think, like, if we just pick 3D printing as a futuristic technology, if you like, it's like, you know, it's like it's building a house. You need bricks to build a house and you can decorate it with the flavors and nutrients you want afterwards. And so you need stuff that's good at making. And one of the great things about milk as well as the idea that it's the only thing that was designed to be food is that it's a liquid that loves to become solids. When it becomes, you know, cheese or butter or yogurt, you know? Mm. So it's good. And so we did these studies on showing how we could print cheese and print different dairy materials. And then we went out and did, as part of our thesis, did studies, consumer studies. And focus groups and surveys with people, and we found that people were very suspicious of the idea of 3D printing. And it was an important reminder for us, you know, that the science and people's understanding of what things mean have to be lined up, you know what I mean? Or else it's not going to work. So it was a timely reminder that consumers, but like, you know, there are lots of views out there. There are people who will say, you know, if it's got more than five ingredients, you should avoid it. It should be bad, you know, that it's going to be bad for you. But like an awful lot of products that are produced, you know, for different purposes, for particular for nutritional purposes, often have to have very long ingredient list.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there are a lot of kind of arbitrary, oh, well, if it's got more than five steps in making it, that's not good for you. If it's got more than five ingredients, it's not good for you. But like in Ireland, like to take an example, like something that's very common that a lot of your listeners might be very familiar with is celiac disease.
Mm-hmm.
And like food science, including a lot of research done in UCC by my colleagues, like, you know, has been you've done great steps in bringing better products and improving the quality of the offerings that are present for celiacs. But that often requires very complex science to engineer a structure and a texture and an eating experience to replicate something that has gluten in it.
For sure.
You know what I mean? So, you know, sometimes science solves, you know, what science is about, food science, no exceptions, it should be about solving problems. You know,
yeah.
And that's you know, an example where food science has done a great job of designing new kinds of products for people. Yeah. I mean, you take the rise of veganism. Like, some of the products which are available on the market for those who choose to pursue that lifestyle are astonishingly complex scientific products. You know, some of the products that are being, like the Impossible Meat Burger, the Beyond Meat Burger, are very long ingredient lists to replicate the meat-like experience, you know, and took years of research. There are people who are trying to make milk now in line of veganism without using cows in fermenters. This is really 21st century biotechnology to address some of these challenges that people want. You know, so on the one hand, for some reasons, people kind of feel the food as, you know, we don't want science coming near our food. We don't want get those molecules out of my food. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, you know, regularly surveys about, you know, we don't want chemicals in food. And to me, that's fine. But what's left? You know, everything is chemical. Water, proteins, lipids, all chemicals. Like, you know, every time you cook, like to me, like other... interacting with food and handling food and cooking food is the most complex scientific thing we do every day other than being alive. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like when you cook something, you unleash a whole series of complex chemical reactions. Food isn't, but yet there's a kind of a rejection of science. But then on the other hand, you know, people put demands like, say, you know, having meat alternatives or milk alternatives, which require enormously complex scientific solutions. You know what I mean?
Yes, for sure.
There's a kind of a complex social place for science in the world of food at the moment.
Absolutely. Just the idea, I'm thinking now of someone getting quite mad at even the comment of how vegetarian or vegan food may require a significant amount of science even just to build it and to make this something which is possible, because it's inherently good. But I don't know how much people with that diet would almost agree with the processing side of it. But again, that's the whole discussion. What I'd like to close on now, and what I'd like, the last thing is, we've talked a lot about how maybe familiarization has been very good. Would you have any warnings of like what might be coming ahead in the world of food processing? Like 3D printing is a good one. It's very interesting. Is there anything else of the like to expect?
No, I mean, I think that a lot of the core technologies that the food industry used is, like, you know, with the rare exception, like 3D print, and there are lots of other ones, like there's using electricity, using pulsed electric fields to again kill bacteria without damage. Because a lot of the kind of the drive is to do the, keep going back to do the basics, which are to make it safe and make it last longer, but try and avoid, you see, heat has been our go-to technology for thousands of years.
Yeah.
But heat is like a very blunt instrument.
Yes.
Because if you heat food, you kill bacteria, you know, you make it safe, you make it last longer, but you change the flavor, you change the color, you destroy nutrients.
Yes.
So the big pursuit and the big trend has been trying to find technologies that do the good stuff of heat in terms of safety and stability, but avoid the negatives.
Yes.
Like I mentioned, the high pressure treatment, but they're using electricity, using, you know, pulsed electric fields, using like plasmas. There's a whole kind of science fiction almost. In fact, there's a big conference in Dublin later this year devoted to new technologies for
cool.
Because this has been a really important part of it. So I think it's like, you know, it's this kind of conversation between what consumers want and then driving, okay, these are the demands for food. And there are a lot of conflicting demands at the moment, because there's natural on the one hand, there's healthy, obviously.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, there could be demands for very specific types of food that require very complex solutions, you know?
So
I think I think a lot of the demand, a lot of the core technologies have been around for a long time. I think what we're seeing more, with the exceptions I mentioned, a lot of the kind of complexity is coming in more in the formulation. And the subtlety is, you know, how we put things together to make that burger, or to make that, you know, that cheese alternative, or to make that, you know, or to make that healthier, you know, less Like, if you go back to my argument earlier on about chemical preservatives, I mean, it's funny how our basic tastes in it, like some of our most fundamental human characteristics around taste are for chemical preservatives. You could for acid, for salt, for sugar. You know, I never quite got my head around. If you think about it, we're kind of programmed and bitter, which is also obviously a flavor more related to probably detected toxins. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it is interesting how we're almost programmed to detect things that have been in food for a very long time, salt and sugar.
Yeah.
The main function of which has been to protect us for a very, very long time, you know? So we're engineered for chemical preservation. Sort
of. Yeah. Really, really cool. Absolutely. What a brilliant conversation. I really loved that. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for the invitation. It was really nice to chat.
This is the end of the podcast. We hope you enjoyed your time. If you're feeling generous and you're not completely skinned, why don't you give us some of your money? Join our Patreon. Join our Patreon. Join our Patreon. Join our Patreon.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.